Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He's my good buddy, incredible macro thinker, Luke Grohman. Welcome back to the show, my friend.
Thanks for having me back on, George. Good to be here again.
All right. Now, you just did a mind-blowing podcast with our good friend Grant Williams, and I was hoping we could kind of expand on that for the viewers. I think you guys spoke for about an hour and 20 minutes. Personally, I wish that would have been about a four-hour conversation, as I know so many people are kind of in my same boat. So what I want to do is kind of start with your end game and then kind of work our way backwards. So with that podcast, just for the viewers who didn't see that, you were talking about the basically all the sovereign nations, the major players. We're talking about Japan, China, the United States, Russia, Saudi Arabia, starting to price their oil for gold, or maybe more specifically, using gold as a reserve asset instead of treasuries. Because we need something that is a neutral reserve asset, is I think the way Keynes described it during Bretton Woods. And I've heard the IMF say that several times. So I guess it's about the world moving to a neutral reserve asset that isn't controlled by any country. And you think that's going to be gold. So I think that's your end game. Can you go ahead and maybe give us your version of that?
Yeah, I think at least in the intervening term, it's gold. I mean, it could. There's no reason it couldn't also be Bitcoin, something like Bitcoin. But that's, right now, gold's on central bank balance sheets. Bitcoin isn't. And so we'll see how that develops. But I think when you look at the combination, the fundamental problem is that in order, peak cheap energy combined with the sovereign balance sheets of the world, in particular the West, and in particular the reserve currency issuer US, means that in order to keep treasury bonds, and we'll pick on treasuries because it's the reserve currency issuer, Europe has some similar problems, but to keep treasury bonds nominally AAA rated, you can't, by definition, keep them AAA rated on a real basis, particularly in oil terms, right? So basically, peak cheap energy means it's getting more and more expensive to grow and find the marginal oil barrel. That's likely to continue. And while there are some alternative energy things we can do, the fact of the matter is oil and gas are still, whatever, 70, 80% of our global energy consumption. And that's not going to change in a time horizon that I think is relevant for this discussion. So oil is going to keep getting more expensive if you take out sort of, cyclical moves, right? So oil is going to rise, which means treasury bonds, particularly with rates at zero or 25 basis points after today, I suppose, are going to lose value against oil just on the geology of oil alone.
Right.
Then when you take into account the sovereign balance sheets of the West, of the US specifically, you have the situation where they can't afford to let rates rise very much to compensate you for the rising energy costs. And right. So they're going to have to basically at some point grow their balance sheet to, they have to keep real rates significantly negative. And we've seen that. And you and I talked a year ago and I said, look, I think real rates are going to at least negative five, maybe negative 10 or 15. And people at the time were kind of laughing. And of course, they're not laughing now. Here we are, negative eight. So it's this fundamental problem where to get the West out of the problem they are with their debt load, particularly in the context of a peak cheap energy world, you've got to have significantly negative real rates, but that, and particularly in energy terms, but that doesn't work if you're a creditor. That means basically you have an ice cube of savings that's melting away at 8 to 10% per year in energy terms, which really matters because if you don't have enough energy, you're going to starve, economy collapse, a whole slew of bad things that political leaders.
Yeah, why don't you give an example of a country that would be applicable to? Because I think that'll help the listener kind of get their mind around what you're saying. So if you're a country, I think the way you termed it with Grant is if you're long dollars and short energy, then
you're holding onto those
dollars in treasuries. And if the treasuries are of a negative real yield, then your purchasing power, or what, how many barrels of oil you can buy with those treasuries, is decreasing. And that's bad news if you're a Japan or a China.
A Japan, China, Europe.
Yeah.
And it's, and quite frankly, it's bad news for Russia too, right? You sell a bunch of oil today at, you know, 100, and then in 10 years, it's 400. You would have been better off just leaving it in the ground, because you're not going to get compensated with interest with rates at zero. And the U.S. can't let rates rise enough to do that. So you, that is both sides of the coin. It doesn't work for anybody. It doesn't work for the U.S. middle class or working class. It only works for sort of this narrow set of interests that are closest to the dollar system. So I think what we're seeing is the system feeling itself out, the different players trying to enforce their desire to move to a system with a neutral reserve asset, right? Because at the end of the day, gold is just a 0% yielding bond, right? Okay, so treasury is 0% yielding bond, gold is a 0% yielding bond. Gold is infinite duration, treasury is finite duration. Gold is finite issuance, treasuries are infinite issuance. And gold has an infinite face value and treasury has a finite face value. And you could use some of these, apply some of these same things to Bitcoin, and it's even more attractive, I think, on the issuance side than gold is. But the point is that in the situation where we are with energy, with sovereign debt where it is, you need to move to a system with a neutral reserve asset. And if you don't do that, volatility is going to rise and the system's going to increasingly see commodity producers decide, you know what, I'm just going to leave it in the ground. I would rather have oil than treasury. So I'll just leave it in the ground. I'll take out what I have to take out and to pay my dollar debt, and anything else I'm going to leave in the ground, and the system will break down.
Do you think the pushback from the central planners would be, okay, we want a neutral reserve asset, but we don't want one where we can't control the supply? And because when I go back to the IMF, you know, they kept talking about the digital SDR. That they want to be, that to be kind of the neutral reserve asset you're referring to. It's just with all these central banks around the world, I understand why they would want to replace treasuries with gold, especially if their problem is energy. But you know, replacing that their reserves with something that constrains them to a certain degree, I think they would see as less than ideal. Obviously, I think they'd like to have it where they could print their own currency to buy the energy, but then that potentially puts them in the same position that the United States has been in with Triffin's paradox. So, you know, how do you see that playing out?
I think the ESDR or something like that acting as some sort of neutral reserve asset probably would have worked up until 3 weeks ago, weeks ago, right? Because now, not only did the US and EU say that your dollar and euro FX reserves are no good, Russia, but a week later they came out and said IMF SDRs are also no good, Russia. Mm. So I think they basically, in a week's time, put a bullet in both of those options. And so you kind of go through the balance sheet and it's like, all right, well, FX reserves, there's a bullet in that one. IMF SDRs, there's a bullet in that one. The only thing left there is gold. And so, you know, can they come up with something else in the time frame that they probably need to get this done, given what we're watching in terms of, you know, assuming things don't get resolved in geopolitically quickly? No, I don't think there's anything else to fall to. I think it falls to basically gold, at least for the time being. And then maybe you can move to something else, or you tie the SDR to it. But I don't think they have a lot of choice at this point, because they've discredited all the other options, in my view.
Yeah. And what's interesting is your hypothesis is they may have done that on purpose. So meaning that, like, the United States, the West, let's say, they say, okay, we're going to freeze Russia's reserves to send a message to all the other central banks around the world that they need to unload treasuries and start loading up on gold, so we can transition into this new type of reserve asset system and move away from the Bretton Woods 1.0 system.
I think there is in any country, multiple factions in Washington. And I think there is a faction that didn't like this idea of freezing the reserves. And I think you can see that if you read the headlines of the weekend before they did it, you had JP Morgan and Citigroup and Jamie Dimon warning that, look, this has dollar implications, right? Which is interesting, right? They people say, well, I listen to Jamie Dimon and everything. Jamie Dimon saying, hey, don't do this. You know, this has dollar implications. And then after they did it, people are like, well, this doesn't have dollar implications. It's kind of like, but no, I think there are factions within the US like there are in any government. I think there is the sort of Fed Treasury faction that really like this dollar system. And look, if I was sitting in their seat, I get why they do it. I think at some point you have to start being a little bit more selfless and look to the country, but it comes down to a belief system. And so look, this has been a great system for them. It's been wonderful for them. And so you could see them angling to not do this. Defense, on the other hand, has been very vocal for 10 years talking about defense supply chains and pointing out that it's, you know, that basically they've been borrowing, we've been borrowing money from China to build weapons, to face down China using Chinese weapons or Chinese supply chains and Chinese components. And I mean, that's literally probably the only economic relationship in the world right now that makes less sense than the German-Russian gas thing that everybody's been making fun of the Germans for. But I guess when you live in glass houses, you probably shouldn't throw stones. But like, it's way more ridiculous that we literally are considering China our number one adversary for the next 20 years, and our defense supply chains don't work without China, using money we borrow from China. I mean, it literally makes no sense. So there's these two factions of defense, and defense, they've sworn an oath to the Constitution, and they care about logistics. War fighting is all about logistics. And they're looking at their supply chains going, good God, right? If this is our most likely potential adversary, this is a disaster. And so they've been angling for this for 10 years. So I think there's these sort of two factions of sort of Fed, Treasury, defense. And in my view, one way or another, it looks like defense kind of won. It allows us to project and wield this dollar weapon, but ultimately it gets us to an outcome that I think is a prerequisite to being able to restructure US supply chains and start to rebolster the American middle class and working classes again in a way we haven't seen in 40 years.
Do you think there's a way they would try to thread the needle to kind of have their cake and eat it too? And what I mean by it, because, and I want to kind of clear things up here and put this into terms that I think my audience will understand. When you're talking about the banksters pushing back, we got to understand that they set up this euro dollar system to benefit them going all the way back to the 1950s. So I always say that it isn't necessarily the dollar that's the global reserve currency, but it's the dollar infrastructure. And these banks make a tremendous amount of money on that infrastructure. So they are heavily incentivized to keep moving forward with the system we already have in play. So even if these global governments are saying, hey, we want to move out of this dollar system, this euro dollar system, and start keeping our reserves in gold instead of dollars or a claim on dollars, basically a treasury, then they're going to get a lot of pushback from the Jamie Dimon types, and who knows how much power and control they have over the politicians at the end of the day. But this, correct me if I'm wrong, but this assumes that by the countries themselves opting for gold instead of treasuries or dollars, that the dollar would no longer be the world reserve currency. Is there a world in which the dollar is still the reserve currency, but goes down, let's say, to 50 on the DXY, so the United States can bring back that manufacturing base to appease the defense group in the United States, while at the same time allowing the banksters to continue with their dollar infrastructure, the dollar being the world reserve currency, but just the dollar is devalued basically against all other currencies. Am I missing something there? Is that possible? What do you think the probabilities of that are?
That's my base case. I think the dollar will be reserve currency for, you know, my lifetime. But I think it's going to be restructured. If you look at pretty much everything I've ever written, tweeted, anything about this, I never say the dollar's reserve status is going to end. I'll say the post-71 status is going to be restructured or will be changed. The problem is that we use the dollar as a reserve currency and the treasury as primary reserve asset. And that's the real issue, which is it forces us to become the Saudi Arabia of treasuries.
Right.
And not make anything else. And so if, I mean, the dollar was reserve currency from 46 to 71 with gold in the mix. You know, so there's more there than just, it's just this restructuring. 46 to 71, dollar was reserve status, and the U.S., you know, did well in the Cold War and had a booming economy and low inflation and a whole bunch of really good things. So I think you can, and by the way, was industrialized enough to actually be able to fight multiple wars and the Cold War without help from another nation, which I think is the key point in terms of the logistics, supply chains, and the onshoring that this would drive. So my base case is that we go back to some sort of system with dollars still a reserve currency. Treasuries are no longer the primary reserve asset. And you got to find more demand for those. And you can see the regulations. Banks have to buy them for capital and liquidity needs and collateral needs and. So they're creating demand that you have to hold them in the domestic banking system to, I think, basically try to ready for this, basically, or at least to sort of deal with the deficits we're seeing. It's probably not the ready for this, but it's probably to deal with the deficits we've been seeing in the absence of sufficient foreign buying of these treasuries. But yeah, it's my base case, is that basically you will see gold, it'll be gold at a floating price, as opposed to, you know, the problem with Bretton Woods was not that it was gold. The problem was it was gold pegged to the dollar, and we were printing too many dollars. And, you know, we ran out of gold. And or before we did, we closed the gold window. If you use it as the settlement asset on a floating basis, you know, when the U.S. starts running deficits for that, gold starts rising in dollars and rising in dollars and rising in dollars. And at some point, you know, it's going to force, you know, it will force higher inflation, higher economic growth. There will be, you know, listen, you want to go fight a war, great, but you're going to fight a war and it's going to inflate your economy. It's not going to inflate the Europeans and the Chinese and the Japanese, which is really what the neutral reserve asset setup does. And yeah, I think that's where this is going. I think it has to go there, because the alternative is, as much as sort of the financial side of the U.S. house doesn't like it, the alternative's horrifying. They haven't thought through what the alternative is.
Yeah. How would it work? And this is probably a stupid question, but how would it work if we had a trade deficit and gold was the settlement asset or the reserve? I mean, would it go back to kind of the way things were on a gold standard, where if we ran, let's say, a $100 billion deficit for 1 month, then we would be able to send them dollars, or would we have to send them gold? And would it work with it? I go back to Hume, where he talked about that, I think it was called that price specie flow mechanism, where if one country is running a significant trade surplus, then they're going to receive more gold, which would increase their domestic money supply, which would increase prices and therefore give them a competitive disadvantage. And the country that ran the trade deficit would have an advantage. So you kind of get this equilibrium. How would that work under this new kind of 1971 restructuring of the dollar deal?
To me, I think it really would center around energy, right? Where I think everybody, you'd basically peg gold to oil, right? So you say, whatever, 100 barrels an ounce, 200 barrels an ounce, something, right? And if you want cheap oil, you have to have cheap gold. Your currency has to be strong in gold if you want to have cheap oil. So China wants cheap oil. It wants to build a consumer society. Europe has to have cheap oil for all the production they do. Japan. So you're going to have the yuan for China strong against gold, low gold price. The United States, on the other hand, actually has a robust domestic production of oil. And at the right price, we can produce a lot of it. And so we, on average, it's better for us to have a higher oil price. Well, if we want a high oil price, we're going to need to have a high gold price. The dollar will have to be weak in gold. And I think if you basically, through the flows of energy, pegged to gold, it basically goes from a centralized, the Fed makes monetary policy for everybody and you guys all deal with it, which is running into problems because of debt and peak cheap energy, to the major currency blocks make decisions based on energy policy, based on what's best for their citizens and their own economic needs, and decentralizes that decision-making, right? So Europe wants, you know, cheap oil so they can produce stuff. And by the way, this isn't just about taking away the US's sort of monopoly of, hey, we can have cheap gold and expensive oil and it's great for us and it sucks for everybody else. This is also about, you know, the mercantilism of China, right? You want to have a cheap currency, then you're going to have cheap or expensive energy, right? Mm. So if you want to have, you know, a cheap energy, you're going to have an expensive currency. And then it comes down to being able to compete. It's actually, you know, free market, which God forbid.
Yeah. So I think the pushback from most people would be, okay, Luke, I get what you're saying, but it doesn't seem like there would be enough incentive for the players involved to move to this new system. So why don't we just go over kind of the key players that have different needs and wants? So maybe like a China, because they're long dollars, short energy, maybe a Russia, because they are long energy, and then maybe compare that to the United States or maybe Saudi Arabia, if you think that's a better example. So starting just country by country, how would this new system benefit? And you know, what would be the pros and cons for China, let's say, a country that's long dollars, short oil or energy with this new system?
So let me take it the other way. What will move people there is, I think, as the situation of not moving there gets closer.
Mm.
So if we don't do that, let's keep running this system out. The Americans can't afford to have positive real rates. They need negative 10, negative 15% real rates for the next 5 to 10 years, just mathematically. Next 3 to 5 years, right? Okay, so now you're going to need 10% inflation, 0% rates in the US. Okay. So inflation in dollar terms is going to rise. Energy prices are going to rise dramatically as that happens, because who wants to buy treasuries or any bonds with that happening? Fed's going to have to do yield curve control. No, they're going to have to cap yields at 2 or 3, whatever they are in treasuries. I don't know when that happens. It doesn't really matter for purposes of this point of here's our alternative. Real rates have to be negative, because the debt level is so high in the West.
And the off-balance sheet debt that you talk about all the time. It's not just the 30 trillion, it's the 150 trillion or whatever it is in unfunded liabilities.
Right. So you got to keep real, but now you've got no one that wants to buy that debt. So the producers in this whole system, the commodity producers in particular, go, why would I sell my oil, my grains, my copper for that? I'm not selling it for that. I'm going to leave it in the ground. I'm going to pull out just enough to pay my dollar debts, and the rest of it, I'm leaving in the ground. And so commodity prices now rise. So now inflation picks up. As inflation picks up, pressure on rates rise. So now the Fed has to buy more because more bondholders are selling into that. This, you will basically, you will see the global trading system break down catastrophically, and people will starve for lack of energy and food, because no one's going to take. There, you don't know when that tipping point is, but you know, you're well on the path when you can only raise rates 25 basis points when inflation's running 7.9%. But I mean, someone asked Powell the question today, right? Why, you know, last time that CPI was 7.9, rates were 15. Why aren't rates 15? Well, the balance sheet's why the rates aren't 15. It's very clear. Like, it's people see it, just people aren't allowed to talk about it. But this is sort of, I think, when you say, what are the incentives to do this? There's a great quote from the former head of the BIS, Yael Zylstra. And it was something, I was trying to look it up here a second ago and I can find it, but it's along the lines of the world got through the first oil crisis and it can make it through the second oil crisis, but it won't make it through the third oil crisis because the creditor nations will begin withholding things from, you know, not, you know, from the consuming nations, because of lack of faith in the preservation of the purchasing power of the debt, and the whole system will collapse.
Yeah, and like, so the oil producers don't produce oil, And i.e. Saudi Arabia, Russia, the stuff producers don't produce stuff because they don't want the dollars that are being traded for the stuff. So then what happens to the global economy when there's less stuff being produced and less energy?
We're right there, right? I mean, like, the Americans can't abide a positive real rate without their sovereign balance sheet collapsing, right? Take rates, you know, let's not even say take them to 15. Let's say he takes them to 10. 10% rates, pro forma interest on the U.S. is $3 trillion. Tax receipts are $4 trillion. You know, they're going to have to print the money to pay the interest. Because then you're going to lop on $2.6 trillion in entitlements. Then you have to lop on $800 billion defense. And then you got to lop on everything else, right? So if they took rates to 10, in order to not default, the U.S. would have to literally print, I don't know, they'd have to be doing $200, $300 billion a month in QE while they're raising rates. Very inflationary. Okay. So that's not possible. At the same time, everybody, you know, the only guy who's really saying, well, there's others saying it as well, but these producers can't trade real value, real finite value with peak cheap energy, peak cheap commodities for paper that's negative 10% yielding on commodity prices. You can't do it. You're literally going to destroy your country. So you've got an immovable force and an unstoppable, you know, object running into each other. And so that's what we're heading towards, right? So it's like, that's the backdrop of this negotiation when you say, okay, what are the forces that are going to push people toward, push nations toward doing this? So let's go to back to your question. China is very interested in doing this because if I'm China, if the Americans, you know, if oil's only priced in dollars and the Americans print $100 trillion for boomers, my oil bill is going to inflate tremendously. I'm going to run out of dollar reserves relatively quickly. When I run out of dollar reserves, I'm not going to have the dollars to buy the oil with. And I'm going to have to cut my oil purchases. My economy is going to collapse. The yuan is going to collapse. And hundreds of millions of people potentially could starve. They're going to have a political crisis. I mean, this is a version of what happened in Southeast Asia in the late 90s. This was Kyle Bass's case. He multiple times said, listen, if we can just get, because oil is only priced in dollars and China needs more and more of it and the price goes up and up, all we got to do is just jack the price of oil. They'll run out of dollars and the yuan will collapse when they run out of dollar reserves. So like, that's their incentive. They've been wanting to move to this system for 15 years, right? We talked about the BIS paper they filed in 09, where they said, we need to reform the international monetary system to something with a neutral reserve asset. So they don't need convincing. The Russians don't need convincing because it's the opposite side of the same coin, which is, you know, they're going to sell a whole bunch of oil for a whole bunch of treasuries. At some point, their oil production will peak and decline like all other oil production has done in every field in the world. And they're going to be left with a pile of treasury paper to go back and buy the energy and food they need, except it's going to be five times more expensive because right, the Russians are out of oil. We've already seen it. Take Russia's oil out of the mix. Oil goes up 50% in 2 weeks. Okay, so they're there. The Saudis are there. They get it, but the Saudis have, you know, numerous constituencies to try to dance between the U.S. with defense, the Chinese being the biggest clients, the real being pegged to the dollar. You know, the Iranians, there's a whole, but it's a tough neighborhood, right? So there's a lot of things to balance there, but they absolutely understand this need for a neutral settlement asset, but there's other more practical things than, to deal with perhaps than maybe the Chinese and the Russians have. Europe, they get it, you know, same thing. They have the same problem as China. Japan has the same problem as China. The Indians have the same problem as China. The Americans were like, hey, tough luck. But now defense is going, guys, like our defense supply chain is, you know, critically, at least it's at critical bottlenecks in China. So this isn't working for anybody. So I think there is, now it's working great for Fed, Treasury, Wall Street for the moment. When, you know, if they don't change things, and this is why I say I think the Fed Treasury angle that those are being short-sighted is, what happens when China collapses? Because they will. On this system, they will, you know, if dollars are only priced in dollars, and as a practical matter, it's already changing. But if we only price in dollars, and oil, in terms of oil, and oil prices go up, China runs out of dollars, China collapses, China's a currency crisis, Wall Street's screwed. right? I mean, well, the whole financial system nearly collapsed when Lehman went bankrupt. It had an $800 billion balance sheet. China's got a $37 trillion balance sheet. There were literally, I mean, all you want to own is gold and dollars and rations, and that's it. Like there won't be markets if they don't change this. So there's, I would say to your question is what's the motivation? I think they have to be close enough to the abyss. And they're just, you know, they're too far from the abyss still. Whereas I think defense, because they have to care about logistics for a living, they've seen for 10 years the problem with this. Wall Street, I think, is starting to, but they're not there yet.
And that Chinese black hole that you talked about with their economy collapsing would suck in those banksters that are part of that euro dollar system that they have profited on so greatly since 1950. So, you know, once they see the writing on the wall, that could light a fire under their tail as well. Say, hey, we got to change this system, because if we don't, the system that we're making a lot of money on right now isn't going to be here in, you know, 2 or 3 years. And then going back, so everyone's on the same page with the people that produce the stuff, or the countries that produce the stuff, like Europe, Japan, and China, that don't have the energy, you know, they're in a very difficult position because they have to continue to sell stuff for dollars. But if the dollar is depreciating in value against oil, especially, they're going to be in a position where they have to trade their labor, their resources, their stuff for dollars that buy them less and less and less oil. And that's not even to mention the dollar denominated debt that they have to contend with, and therefore need dollars. Well, I guess that's a good kind of tangent to go on, Luke, because if they've got dollar denominated debt, does that kind of offset the problem with the oil? Because, you know, if the dollars that they're receiving, I guess, would that make the nominal value of their, or the, you know, the burden of their dollar denominated debt decrease if the value of the dollar was going down, while at the same time those dollars are buying less oil? So would it be, on balance, would it be a push? You see what I'm saying? Like, they're benefiting from their dollar denominated debt going down as far as the burden, but yet they're, you know, they're losing from a standpoint of those dollars are buying less oil.
No, it'd be the other way, because think about it. It's like what we saw in Southeast Asia, right? As the oil is chewing up more and more of their dollar reserves, speculators are going to see clearly what that is, which is they're running out of dollars. And when they run out of dollars, they run out of oil. When they run out of oil, the economy collapses. When the economy collapses, the currency collapses, the dollar goes up against them. So the dollar will be adding fuel to the fire. So now they have the currency collapse. You know, people say, well, that'll be great. They'll sell us stuff cheap because, you know, their currency will collapse, and then they'll make the stuff and they'll sell it cheap and there'll be deflation. People don't go to work when you're looking for food for your kid. That's what people are missing here, is like, if this system goes to its terminus, it's not like everyone's going to wake up for work in the emerging markets and at 8 o'clock and go to the factory and make stuff so they can sell it to the Americans. No, they're going to be out like scrapping for food. And, you know, they're not going to be going to the, you know, they're not going to be going to produce stuff for the Americans. They're not going to be going to produce. I mean, it's literally a breakdown of global trade that you would see. The shortages would show up in America on a lag, but they would show up. And so it's literally, I mean, it's nobody wins. It's literally nobody wins. It's, you know, some lose faster than others, some lose slower than others. With the debt as high as it is, you know, this is no longer a 1997-98 situation where, you know, Southeast Asia blows up and 9 months later the US ISM's at you know, 48 in a recession. This is, you know, Russia has a problem, and within weeks we start seeing problems at European banks in terms of, you know, credit concerns and things like that. And then it goes from there. The leverage just makes it, everything happen so much faster.
Hey guys, I want to remind you to get your tickets to Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the live conference I do twice per year with all of your favorite speakers from the Rebel Capitalist Show and experts in investing, commodities, real estate, freedom, and liberty. All of your favorite topics, all of your favorite speakers. The next Rebel Capitalist Live is going to be in Miami, and tickets increase in price as we get closer to the event. So go to rebelcapitalistlive.com right now to get your tickets to the next Rebel Capitalist Live. It's the conference you cannot afford to miss. It'll help you increase your financial freedom and, more importantly, your personal freedom. You'll get intel that you won't hear anywhere else. Past speakers have included icons in macroeconomics, investing, and personal freedom and liberty. People like Dr. Ron Paul, Robert Kiyosaki, Brent Johnson, Lynn Alden, Jeff Snyder, Richard Werner, Mark Moss, Lynette Zhang, and Robert Breedlove, just to name a few. So once again, go to Rebel Capitalist Live right now and get your tickets today. Yeah, you know, another interesting variable there is I was assuming that demand for the stuff would stay the same, but if the dollar's at 50 on the DXY, then that's going to mean those goods coming in from China are far more expensive for U.S. consumers. Therefore, demand goes down, and therefore they're receiving fewer dollars, which would make it more difficult to not only pay off that debt, but then to buy the oil that they need. So it's I'll have to do a whiteboard video on it. It gets a little confusing because there's so many variables there. But the bottom line here, so now I think we've discussed this from the standpoint of Europe, Japan, China thoroughly. I think the next hurdle for most people would be, why would the United States do this? Now, you talked about how they're incentivized to bring back a lot of the manufacturing because it's an issue of national security. But what else is there? What else? Because I guess the pushback there would be, okay, Luke, I get it, but having the dollar as the world reserve currency gives us this exorbitant privilege, quote unquote. And although we may benefit for bringing manufacturing back home, we would lose this great, great, great asset in which we'll never get back. And the powers that be probably do the cost benefit analysis and say, we'll stick to the dollar being the reserve asset.
They, like, is shit. I don't think it's an exorbitant privilege anymore. It's an exorbitant burden on them, right? Yeah. And so when you've got to beg China for masks in the middle of a pandemic, you, in my opinion, if that doesn't make leadership start to question how much of a benefit it actually is as opposed to a burden or privilege versus burden. And again, it's fine. Where this will go is America will be, you know, effectively, China will make everything. China will produce everything. China will eventually, you know, catch and surpass us on some of this high tech stuff. They've got gazillions of engineers. They can steal IP. They will eventually just economically overtake Taiwan. They won't need to. And at that point, they've got it. And then America will basically be, you know, Panama with lots of farmland. I mean, we're going to have, you know, the Chinese will, you know, wealthy will bring their money here, and they will, you know, buy up our assets and our corporations, and, you know, they'll control our media, right? And you're already seeing signs of that. And so it really is just, it's a critical strategic time to kind of think about of, is this really what we want? I mean, you go back, there's a great defense document from October of 2018, and it just lays out, they can't really fight a war without China's help. Mm. And if you need another country's help to make the stuff to fight a war against another real power, are you still a superpower? Are you? I don't know. Is having the currency still a benefit? I mean, these are questions that need to be being asked. I mean, Yeah, we could wield the dollar against China. We could sanction them, and we can close off their, the Straits of Malacca and choke them off of oil, as some of the U.S. hawks have pointed out. Okay, great. What if they seize all our factories, all the West factories, like we just did to Russia? Then what? Or excuse me, that Russia just did to us in retaliation for us sanctioning, then what? What backs the S&P if the Chinese factories that produce the goods for a lot of S&P companies are grabbed by China? And again, right. So at that point, then you say, hey, we've got dollars. We got dollars. I mean, the reality is in World War II, if I remember the story correctly, the U.S. wouldn't take reserve currency sterling to help the British, and they were our friends. We wanted dollars or gold. So, it's in times, in normal times where things are calm, this system can work. When things start getting tense, when you get into great power competition, when you get into resource constraints, the system is completely ill-suited for that. And you need to be able to make stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, and to your earlier point, it might not even be up to the United States because of what they did 2 weeks ago by freezing the FX reserves of the Russian central bank. They may have just said, whether it was intentional or not, the net result is still the same, and that's that foreign central banks are going to be very, very leery of owning treasuries or dollars in the future. For the simple fact that it's someone else's liability.
Well, think about it. It's great. If you go to this defense report in 2018, it's assessing and strengthening the U.S. defense industrial base or something like that. And, it was under Trump. But then if you look since, Biden has done a lot of the same things in terms of this, industrial reshoring studies and even some modest industrial policy. In the report, if you hit the footnotes, you can hit Control F to search, right? To try to find something within. It's a 140 page document. You search the word dollar. And there's nothing about the dollar in there until you get into the footnotes. And the footnotes of the report note that the Chinese, by buying treasuries, overvalue the dollar and undervalue the yuan, and thereby allow Chinese manufacturing to be competitive vis-a-vis the United States. And the whole point of the 150 pages is the extended period of uncompetitive U.S. industrial has so cleaned us out that it's impacted our warfighting ability. Mm-hmm. And so I think there is, in certain defense and intelligence circles, a clear understanding of the relationship between this dollar system and this deindustrialization that was like all fun and games when it was sort of, capping union wages and offshoring labor and bolstering corporate profits and sort of all of the early stage good things in Washington's eyes. But now it's like the success of the system has bred its own unwind or undoing, right? Like a lot of things, right? Where now it's so overextended. Think about how much time we've spent talking about Taiwan over the last 2 years. I mean, just how did we let that happen? How did we why do we care? If it's not a big deal, why do we care so much about Taiwan? We pulled out of Afghanistan. We've said we won't do fly zones in it, right? So there's, why do we care? Because it's so important to make stuff. It's so important to make that stuff. If it's so important to make that stuff, then why not make it here? And you're seeing signs of it already, right? Intel having the biggest, or being putting in a fab in Ohio, which I wouldn't have believed it if I would have, been told it, even two, let alone five, 10 years ago. Fab in Texas, fab in Arizona. So you've had three semiconductor fabs, Samsung, Taiwan Semi, and Intel announced in the United States in the last 6 months, 8 months, which is really something. So there's, I think, a recognition, like, this is happening. It needs to happen. There are some prerequisites that have to happen with the dollar system, in my view, but it's in everybody's interest. It's sort of a win-win. Look, it's not good if you own a bunch of bonds, but you had a good 40 years. Like, don't be a pig.
Yeah. Well, and I would say that you know, in order for this to happen at great lengths, as far as bringing the manufacturing back to the United States, the dollar, it would be tough if the dollar's at 95.
Oh, it can't be here. It's got to be.
It's a hell of a lot easier at 50 or 60 or, you know, 70, something like that. But then, right. So then the people who really pay the price to reshore all the manufacturing, ironically, is going to be the poor and the middle class, because that means if they think they're paying high prices now, just wait until 95% of the stuff that you buy at Walmart is produced in the United States.
You know, it's the trade-off, right? Because on one hand, when it went to China, right, they got it, you know, 40% cheaper.
Right.
Right. But they went from making $30 an hour full benefits to $12 an hour no benefits. Mm. And here's a subprime loan. And oops, your subprime loan just went away. And now
here's a 401k.
Here's a 401k. Oops, it just went away, right? So it
here's Dogecoin.
It was a great deal right up front, and it's been a bad deal ever since. And this is the same thing where, look, I think we're in the early days of seeing this inflation. I think this inflation is anything but transitory. I think it's structural. You know, of course, you're going to have cyclical moves, but I think this is a very structural inflation. It's going to last for a long time. But again, if the dollar is at 50, manufacturing companies can afford to pay people 40, 50 bucks an hour all in full benefits and still be competitive in theory versus, you know, foreign competition than they could with the dollar at 95. So it's the, you know.
What about the current exporters? What, I mean, they're not going to like that, are they? That's going to be a lot of competition for the some of the superpowers that need to be involved with this transition, like Europe, Japan, China.
They've been mercantilists. Suck it up. They gotta build themselves. Like, look, if they want to change this system, and they've been acting like they want to, they need to create a consumer class. Now, as a practical matter, let's take Europe, right? So in 2018, Jean-Claude Juncker said that it's absurd. He used the word absurd, that we are paying, that our energy bill is 2% in euros and 98% in dollars. It's 300 billion euro a year. It's an enormous amount of money if you switch it over to euros. Okay, what happens if you switch it to euros? Now, all of a sudden, you have freed up dollar liquidity to do other things, right? Where, you know, 300 billion a year can build you a military, can build infrastructure, can build, you know, UBI, whatever you want to do. You basically kind of create some. Now, again, that implies the 300 billion getting settled in some sort of neutral asset, right? So you sort of get hints of how much gold would have to rise to sort of, you know, store some of these flows on the energy creditor side. But
right.
I think that's the answer. Is you have to have, they have to create their own domestic consumption, right? And so you're looking at a world where China has the factories, Europe has the factories, neither one have the consumers. They're going to need to create consumers. How do you create consumers? By increasing credit, right? You know, so that you're going to have to, problem of course is both are very highly levered already. So that then too speaks to some sort of, you know.
Yeah, they've got, it's weird because all countries pretty much are in this position where they have to transition. But that transition is by no means easy.
No.
And you're going to have to crack a lot of eggs to make that omelet. that's most likely what we'll see play out over the, or there's a high probability that that's what we'll see play out. And, you know, to your point with Grant, what's happening between Russia and Ukraine is kind of giving them cover to make this happen without having to admit the system is flawed, the system is broken, and they are going to make this transition whether we like it or not.
Yeah, I mean, to me, yeah, there are great, really great risks because things are so globalized. Everything, all the supply chains globally are optimized for efficiency and not resilience.
Yeah, right.
So you can start to see just little hints of, you know, look, what percentage of global grain production Russia and Ukraine are.
Mm.
Right. That starts to get very scary throughout the emerging markets. You know, when you start to see things like Bayer a couple of days ago, who owns Monsanto, say, you know, we're thinking about cutting off seed sales to Russia in 2023. So you're going to weaponize seeds? Like, that's, you know, this goes down a very ugly path. You know, semiconductors, seizing of factories. There isn't a company or you know, anywhere in the world whose value isn't going to get massively haircut if that starts to happen, right? There's this move to resiliency, and I don't want to say autarky, but more self-sufficient, that I think we're seeing happen simply by virtue of what people don't want, right? Of the supply chain weakness, vulnerability, national defense. You know, U.S. is, it's around national defense. The Chinese, it's around resources constraints. The Europeans, it's kind of resource constraints. You know, India, same thing. So everyone has a set of interests that they don't fit perfectly, but they fit close enough that something can sort of, you know, there's some meeting room where everyone can sort of agree. But, you know, to your point, just like in the U.S., there's competing interests. In every one of these places, there's competing interests. Yeah. There's relative winners and losers and different relative political powers. And it's mechanically, it's really easy. If I was king of the world, I could have this thing smoothed out in, you know, in 6 months if I didn't listen to anybody and I didn't mind cracking those eggs, et cetera. But I'm not the king of the world. No one's king of the world. And there's competing interests in each of these different places, even though I think sort of the Nash equilibrium is pretty clear, right? I'm just laying out the Nash equilibrium, that's sort of the point that maximizes everybody's interest. It's there. It's a neutral reserve asset. Now, can we get there, or do we need to burn the joint down like we've done a couple times in the past?
Do you think if this system plays out, and obviously there are no certainties, there are only probabilities, do you think in 5 years or so, that the world looks far more like it did when we were growing up, as opposed to the last, let's say, 20 years? And what I mean by that is, for those of you who are a little younger than myself or Luke, when we were growing up, the world was really divided into East and West, and not like it is today. I mean, the East only did business with the East, and the West really only did business, for the most part, with the West. It was just, you know, there was that line in the sand where they had their own economy and we had our own economy and way of doing things. Do you think we'll see that again in the future, where you've got a group of countries that kind of join forces and say, okay, we're going to create our own currency system. We're going to create our own system for trading energy. We're going to create, our own agreements. And then the other, you know, the Australias, the Canadas, the United States, the Western Europe says, we're just going to do the same thing, and we're just not going to pay attention to that other side of the world.
I think it's very possible, because when you, some of what we're discussing is fundamentally cultural differences, right? In terms of systems of governance and rule of law and property protections and things like that. And some of these things you may not be able to come to some sort of consensus on. And so it's possible. I don't know. I think it's possible.
If that happens, and if the major oil producers, because I'm thinking about the low-cost oil producers right now. And one thing that I haven't seen many people really think through is, you know, everyone looks at the ruble going to 150, and now it's back to what, 120 or 110, something like that.
95. It's actually up 35% in the last week.
Wow. Okay.
That was my reaction when I saw it this morning. I'm like, what?
But when it went to 150, everyone is talking about how this is just going to collapse the Russian economy. And I tweeted out, you know, I get there's downside, but let's think about this, because, you know, their currency is being devalued. Their revenues for a large part are in dollars. Their expenses are rubles. So doesn't that mean that profit margins go through the roof with these energy producers? You know, so, but my point there is, if you take the Russia, which I think when the ruble is about 150, they were the lowest cost oil producer in the world,
you know, easily
in dollars.
Yep.
But then when you take the Russias, the Iran, the Venezuela, who else is really low? Saudi Arabia is super, super low. But the group that would form kind of the quote unquote East, I think would have 95% of the cheap oil. So how does that work? If the, you know, the, now it's just India, Russia, China, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Venezuela, basically everyone that we've pissed off over the past, everyone that we've weaponized the dollar against.
By the way, yeah, by the way, there's a lot of Europe that's playing both sides right now, that it's going to be like, yeah, we love you, we love you, we love you. In about 2 years, and you're like, surprise, pissed
yeah.
off.
But, so I guess maybe the better question is, what does the West do if they have to exclusively survive on the oil they produce?
I think it's an even bigger question than oil, right? Like, these things have been building up for so long. I remember reading an article in the Financial Times in 2013, where it said that for the first time in 300 years, the emerging markets were the majority of global GDP, right? So like, there is no precedent for what we're living through. For the first time ever, emerging markets are the majority of oil production. China is the world's biggest trading partner, surpassing the United States like 5 years ago. You know, there's sort of the Mackinder theory, right, of Eurasia, you know, whoever rules the Eurasia, the world island, controls the world. And U.S. foreign policy, Anglo-American foreign policy, you forget it, U.S., but Anglo-American policy going back 100 plus years has been influenced, at the very least, that's probably understating the case, has been influenced by Mackinder policy. Keep, you know, keep the Germans away from the Russians, away from the Chinese, basically, right? Keep that whole gigantic economic powerhouse separated from each other. And now they're coming together in some way, shape, or form. You know, yes, right now, I think, you know, Germany, Russia, the situation there may be a little bit more fluid in the short run. I don't think it's fluid in the long run. I think they're telling you all you need to know with the Gazprom, you know, with the Nord Stream 2 and the pipelines, et cetera, in the long run. I think they see their future tied going east, not west.
Mm.
That's where it gets really tricky, right? When I say, can you see this split, is culturally, they want to do things a certain way. We want to do things a certain way. You know, we have enough to go on our own, but do we have enough, you know?
At what price though?
Yeah, they've got a lot of cat. They take their ball and go home. We take our ball and go home. That's a lot of disruption, right? So it's, you know, it's Harold Malmgren gave an interview where he talked of meeting Putin, you know, a couple decades ago. And, you know, basically talked about the way they problem solve in Russia is everybody gets together as a dinner. Both sides get together. It's understood that everybody at the dinner is armed. And that if they don't come to an agreement at the dinner, it's going to get bloody. And so inevitably something gets resolved that is maybe not, you know, maybe not mutually acceptable, right, to everybody at least. And they move on. And so it, to me, it feels like this almost has to be like what happens, because, and maybe it's the optimist in me, ironically enough, that I don't know how, I mean, I don't know what that other side of things looks like. And yeah, that's, I kind of go back to, like, you know, the banks was like, oh, this dollar system, like, you don't understand. You keep pushing this thing, like, it, geologically and debt wise, it's going to break chaotically. So they, let's, you know, the time to get a parachute out is not when you're 100 feet from the ground. It's when you're, you know, a mile up or whatever, you know, 2000 feet up. Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, look at the price.
You know what I think it boils down to, Luke, is, you know, our good friend Art Berman, one of the first times I interviewed him, he just said something that will stick with me forever. He just says, energy is the economy.
Energy is the real currency, right? Like, if you think about the economy in terms of energy as the currency, not the dollar, everything starts to make way more sense.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. So let's try to bring this home with something that's very relevant to what we're living through right now. And that's this, the issue with Russian Ukraine, which is obviously a hot topic for everyone. There, most of the mainstream media seems to believe that Russia went in there and they tried to kind of take over, or their objective was to take over Ukraine in 3 days. And since they haven't done that, it just shows that they're not able to execute their game plan. And it just shows how ineffective they are. And they're just kind of like chickens running around with their head cut off. But in your podcast with Grant, you highlighted how dependent the world is on Russian oil. And if the world doesn't get Russian oil, it doesn't happen overnight, but eventually you go into a global recession. And that starts to inflict some serious economic pain on a lot of countries, including the United States. So having said that, do you think that it's possible that Putin didn't want this to end in 3 days? Because if it ended in 3 days, then that wouldn't inflict the economic pain that he wanted to on the West to remind them of how much leverage he actually has.
I don't know. I suppose it's possible. I mean, I think I don't know, since I'm not in his head. The one thing I do feel strongly about is that I think he understood that if things did go on, if they did take his oil out of the market, that I wouldn't be surprised if they calculated to the week when you would start to see GDP fall, banking crises in Europe, industrial production shutdown, you know, banking crises in Europe and spread like that. I think they understood that basically the West's balance sheet at the sovereign level in particular,
right,
was not conducive to a recession, made a recession on, and they probably trusted that they might have, in the short run, Russia may have trusted that too much, that hey, they will just give us whatever they want rather than feel that pain. I suspect maybe they've been a little surprised that, wow, they're actually going to try to, you know, they're actually saying they're going to be willing to take a recession. Now, we'll see, right? We're already seeing, you know, the Treasury market, you know, acting a little dysfunctionally, as Mark Cabana at Bank of America said last week. You're seeing European bank stocks sell off. You've seen, you know, some of these sort of tremors of, you know, issues, even, you know, LME, you know, nickel having, you know, shut down and these things. So these are all still early stage symptoms of what could ultimately be a crisis. So I think it factored into his calculus. I suspect that they've been surprised that the West has at least said they're willing to take the pain. You know, the pain isn't here yet. We're all, you know, we're very bold about that. We'll take the pain. You know, let's see if the Fed stands aside, if, you know, we start having, you know, really messy markets, and then that might change the calculus, but that will have costs of its own. So that's, I guess, how I'd answer that.
Yeah. And so just to make sure everyone's following there, if energy is the economy, but the economy equals tax receipts. So if we have less oil because of Russia, then economy goes down. That means tax receipts for the United States and other countries goes down. And in a country that's 130% debt to GDP, you cannot have tax receipts go down, especially if you have inflation going up, which is supposed to increase the amount of tax revenue that you're generating. So that's kind of the leverage game that's being played right now.
Yeah, and that's where it gets into, I mean, we're not going to default on the debt. They'll print the money in theory, but, you know, it puts them on the clock. It puts a lot of pressure on the system. And the problem is once the system breaks, if you wait too long to address it, once the system breaks, you know, then you get to what we had, you know, a couple of years ago, where it's no longer, well, we're just going to hold off on rate hikes. Now you're going to need really epic amounts of QE again to sort of calm things down in the bond markets.
Yeah. So this, and I know I've kept you too long here, Luke, I apologize. But one last question is, one thing I was just shocked by today is not the fact that the 10-year went up to, I think, 2.1, but the 2-year went up to like 1.92. So we're talking about inflation. We're talking about, you know, the dollar weakness and whatnot, but at the same time, you've got the yield curve flattening. How does that happen?
It's not good. I mean, I can't remember. I don't have it off the top of my head. I'm sure I've read it at some point in the past, how rarely it is that the Fed has tightened and, you know, raised enough to invert the curve themselves, right? Like it rarely happens, if I remember right. And, you know, now with what you described, I mean, you're talking about the twos, tens inverting.
Yeah.
With the next 25 basis points. So,
right. Yep.
I think it highlights the mess they're in, really, right? Of, and I think the sovereign debt position, the fiscal position of the U.S. is such that if the Fed does not do enough in terms of helping to finance these deficits, the outcome is pretty clear. You should see higher short-term rates. You should see slower growth. You should see stronger dollar, flattening curve, because ultimately you've got this, you know, the U.S. government effectively crowding out global dollar markets with the Fed not supplying additional liquidity. So it's you know, de facto tightening, right? If the Fed's not financing enough of the U.S.
Yeah, but I'm just not understanding why the long end isn't going up, because if the Fed's tightening, if we got this inflation, you got negative yields on the 10-year, let's say, eight. So let's just say it's two. So negative real yields at 6%. You know, how on earth is the 2-year at 2.1% when the Fed raises the 10-year up to 2.1%, 2-year up to 1.92, if the Fed is buying less, which now they're buying zero. So it just doesn't make sense to me why that long end isn't going up, unless the long end is saying, hey, that the we've got serious probability here of a recession, in which case, although we may see inflation long term over the next 6 months or year, the long end of the curve sees more disinflation. Maybe that's it.
I think that's part of it. I think it's probably the biggest part of it, is you still see a lot of people believing that, you know, inflation is going to go from 7 or whatever, 8 to 2 this year,
right, right,
by the end of the year. And right. I think it's very dependent. I mean, we'll see. I think it's, I think if we came out and said, hey, so it's going to be 7 for the next 3 years, I think it'd be a very different story. And I think the Fed's trying to thread that needle, right? I think they know they need it to be 7 for the next 3 years or more, but they can't say that. They can't do that. They have to, they're trying to ride the two horses with one ass, right? Which, yeah, is, we want to fight, yeah, inflation, we want to inflate the debt away. And it's like, well, and so far they've done a good job. So I think it's more that there's still enough sort of, you know, believers that it is transitory. That's where I fall down is, you know, if you have a recession, you've got problems on the fiscal side, the sovereign balance sheet side, and there's still just not enough press on that, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. And it goes back to the tax receipts. All right, buddy, boy, what a conversation. That was awesome. I sure appreciate your time, Luke. For the viewers and listeners who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go?
Absolutely. You can go to fftt-llc.com, find out about our different product offerings, and on Twitter, at Luke Groman, LukeGroMen.
All right. Thanks, Luke. Have a good one.
All right. Thanks, George. Take care, bud.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel. Yeah.